America Radio proudly presents the Tom Hartman Program, Truth in Broadcasting.
So what makes a real conservative and what makes America? What are the foundational values of this country? What are the foundational values of the various groups that operate in this country, from conservatives to liberals? And what has George Bush and, well, and the Republican Party, let's say, over the last 30 years done about that? Michael Tanner is with us. By the way, welcome to the program. Tom Hartman here with you. Welcome to the first hour of our three-hour program, Tom Hartman. Michael Tanner is here with us. He's the director of the Cato Institute, Cato.org's Health and Welfare Studies Department, and he's the author of a new book, Leviathan on the Right, How Big Government Conservatism Brought Down the Republican Party. Michael Tanner, welcome. Welcome to the Tom Hartman program.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you today.
Glad to have you. First of all, Leviathan, Thomas Hobbes was the title of his book, and he arguably is the original modern conservative thinker, in as much as he acknowledged private property, he acknowledged representative government. This was right after the Glorious Revolution. In fact, actually it was before the Glorious Revolution. It was the installation of Charles II, as I recall. And he was Hobbes was the tutor to Charles II, wasn't he?
That's right.
Yeah, and so he was writing to justify kingdom, but he was also writing to justify kingdom in the context of a government where the people had some representation. Did you choose that, the title for your book, in any way based on Hobbesian thought?
Well, I think it reflects several, actually, books. The original Leviathan, and then there's been several other books that have used that in their title and in their way of thinking over the years to reflect the idea of the growing state and the conflict between the state and the individual. And for a long time, at least among conservatives, the idea was that the threat of the Leviathan state was something that came from the left. But I think in the last few years, at least over the last 10 or so, the threat has increasingly come from the right. And I thought,
why not the last 26? I mean, Ronald Reagan grew government faster than any president before him, with the exception of Franklin Roosevelt during World War II.
Well, I think there's something to that, especially during Reagan's second term. Reagan, at least rhetorically, still reflected small government conservatism, and he did reduce discretionary domestic spending in his first term by about 6%. Much of the increase came under defense spending, and you can argue one way or the other about that, but the George Bush is certainly spending across the board, domestic, defense, foreign, almost everything.
Right, and you see this as a bad thing. I see conservative. You know, I was at the Conservative Political Action Conference a couple of weeks ago, doing the program live from there, and had just, you know, literally one conservative after another on the program for two or three days in a row, and I was hearing this constant drumbeat of unhappiness, not just about George W. Bush, but about the direction that the Republican Party, by and large, has gone over the last 20 years, 25 years. It seems like Barry Goldwater was the last conservative real conservatives had any hope might have governed the United States in a way that was consistent with that philosophy. And of course we'll never know because he didn't govern America. Is that a reasonably accurate statement?
Yeah, actually I think it is. Goldwater was a true believer in limited government, pretty much across the board. I mean, he believed about it in your personal life,
Goldwater believed abortion should be legal, that the drugs should be decriminalized, that people should not be prosecuted for sexual activity as long as it was between consenting adults. He was in favor of essentially civil rights for gays, certainly toward the end of his life. He was almost a libertarian, I suppose, in some regards.
Well, in many ways, I think he is. I certainly think that he had disagreements with libertarians, but we all disagree with one another. Sometimes I disagree with myself.
So here's the question: If Goldwater was the last conservative, and in your book you quote Russell Kirk, and you know Russell Kirk, his book The Conservative Mind in 1952, was the book that really got William F. Buckley going, you know, in 1955 with the National Review, and really, right, frankly, informed Barry Goldwater. And you list Kirk's six canons of conservative thought, I congratulate you for doing that. One of the primary core thoughts of conservative thought, and this goes back to Edmund Burke, which is the essence of the first chapter of Kirk's book, is that civilized society requires orders and classes. And to what extent, you know, it just seems to an awful lot of us looking that the traditional liberal view of government, going all the way back to Thomas Jefferson starting the University of Virginia as a free college so that there could be a relatively classless society, so that people could easily move from class to class, over the objection of conservatives of the day, like Alexander Hamilton, actually Hamilton was probably dead by that point, but you know, John Adams, let's say, who felt that society should be rigidly stratified by class, and that there was a threat to society with people moving easily from one economic class to another.
Okay.
How do you sell that to the American people?
Well, I quite agree, and actually I don't consider myself a Kirkian conservative. I consider myself more of a classic liberal, and in the book I say that the American conservative experience has really been two strands of conservatism that have sort of had an uneasy alliance. One is this classical liberal idea of individual liberty, and the other has been more that sort of draws from John Stuart Mill, and the other is a more Burkean conservatism that places a great deal of emphasis on tradition and the merits of the bourgeois society. I think that these have been sort of in an uneasy alliance for a long time, but both of them have now been supplanted by the new type of conservatism that values government power to enforce conservative ends. And I think that both Kirkian conservatives and libertarian conservatives would both be appalled at what's happened to the conservative movement today.
And the government power that's being used to enforce conservative ends means government power to get in your face, to get into your life, to get into your emails, to get into your home without a warrant, to hold you on an unlimited basis without having your day in court without habeas corpus. I mean, on and on it goes. Is that that's how I would characterize. Is that what you're talking about here, Michael Tanner?
Well, that's certainly part of it. And I devote a chapter in my book to how George W. Bush has centralized power in the presidency to a degree that we haven't seen, at least since Nixon, and possibly even further back than that. There's been a centralization of power. There's been a diminution of the idea of individual liberties. But there's also been just a general sense of social engineering on the right, the idea that they can devise a perfect set of incentives and penalties to get people to behave exactly the way they want. So we'll spend $1.5 billion to teach poor people that marriage is a good thing.
Right, abstinence.
All those sorts of things that will give money to faith-based charities because they do what conservatives want them to do. Things that would have been considered pork when liberals did them are now suddenly good policy because conservatives are doing them, and that's simply wrong.
Well, I'm not sure liberals were ever proposing spending millions and millions of dollars to promote abstinence over the use of condoms to reduce AIDS, for example. I mean, it's an absurd notion. I don't know of any liberals who would have promoted that. But, you know, point taken. So, first of all, I find it fascinating that we're talking with Michael Tanner with the Cato Institute, cato.org. Leviathan on the Right, his new book, How Big Government Conservatism Brought Down the Republican Revolution. Number one, that you're still calling this conservatism. Number two, that all this said, you would still, I assume, correct me if I'm wrong, you would still argue that there should be no Department of Education or federal assistance to education. There should be no Social Security system that is government mandated and the government run. That there should not be a national health care system. That Medicare and Medicaid should be done away with. That unemployment insurance should be, you know, disposed of. That basically the New Deal should be rolled back. Because all of that stuff in your mind is socialism.
Sure, I make no apologies for the fact that I am a traditional small government Goldwater conservative. I believe the government that governs best governs least. I believe the government shouldn't be involved in most areas of our life. We should go about it.
So back to my original question, how do you sell that? We just have a minute left here, Michael. How do you sell that to people? I mean, when you say to people, you know, Bush is having a terrible time. You say to people, I want to do away with Social Security. They go, what?
Look, even as the Republicans were going down to defeat in the last election, the polls showed that the public, by substantial majority, thought the government was doing too many things that are best left to the private sector.
But when you asked them what those things were, they couldn't answer.
Pardon?
But when you asked them what those things were, they couldn't answer. In other words, they were repeating talking points that they'd heard on right-wing talk radio, but they didn't have specifics.
I have more faith in the American people than that. I think we're basically a people that want to go about our lives without the government looking over our shoulders and telling us how to educate our kids, what doctor we should see, what charities we should support.
And we don't want the government backstopping us if we have a disaster in our lives.
Well, the idea that there should be some limited safety net, we can discuss. What does the best job for a safety net? That doesn't mean the government needs to run things.
Or the safety net. Interesting. Michael Tanner, the Cato Institute, Cato.org, his new book, Leviathan on the Right, How Big Government Conservatism Brought Down the Republican Revolution. A lot of good food for thought. Michael, thank you for being with us on the program.
Anytime.
16 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. What are the roots of conservative thought, and where are they taking us? How crazy is it going to get in America? 16 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, where despair is not an option. Get active. This is Air America Radio.
From the conservative weapons of mass deception. Tom Hartman here with you, 21 minutes past the hour. Well, the libertarians are splitting with the conservatives. You can see that from the Cato Institute and from our guest. A lot of Republicans are splitting from the conservatives, or arguably the conservatives are saying, well, the Republicans aren't us. Rudy Giuliani isn't a conservative, and Mitt Romney is. And if Doonesbury's been having a lot of fun with Mr. Romney. Oh, we're so pleased that you support gay rights. Well, actually, I don't anymore. We're so pleased that you support abortion rights. Well, actually, I've changed my mind on that. Yeah. But see, here's the bottom line. What libertarians, who I refer to as Republicans who want to smoke dope and get laid, and conservatives are promoting in the United States, and have been promoting for the better part of 230 years. This is nothing new. You know, the real genesis of modern conservative and liberal thought goes back to the debate, as it were, between Thomas Hobbes and John Locke. Hobbes writing in the early part of the 1600s, Locke writing in the later part of the 1600s. Hobbes writing in large part to justify the ascension of Charles II to the throne, back to the throne after they kicked out Oliver Cromwell. And Locke writing to justify the Glorious Revolution when they kicked out Charles II's brother, James II, and said, enough of this king stuff already, and threw him out, and, you know, in the Glorious Revolution, exiled him to France, and then brought William and Mary in. But before they did, they passed the first British Bill of Rights. As I recall, this was in 1688. I may be wrong, but it's more or less right around then. And that was the beginning, arguably, of democracy in the United Kingdom. And so John Locke was arguing for democracy. And Hobbes was basically, and the difference between the two was real simple. And it continues to this day to be the fundamental difference between liberal and conservative thought. And that is that the conservatives believe that the essential nature of humans is evil. Thomas Hobbes writing about, if the essential nature of humans was allowed to act out, our human nature was allowed to actually be free and unfettered, we would live in a state of perpetual war, because war is the natural state of mankind, according to conservative thought. And that without the restraining force, the iron fist of government or church, life would revert to its original state and be nasty, brutish, and short. Whereas John Locke came along and said, no, the natural state of humans is to be good. And that we form government in order to allow people to maximize their potential, and others to fulfill what's in the goodness that's inherently within them. Whereas Hobbes said, no, you create government to restrain people from the evil that's in them. And everything else comes out of that. I mean, you can boil all of conservative and liberal thought down to those two basic notions. Conservatives fundamentally believe that humans are evil and therefore need to be restrained and never trusted. And liberals believe that humans are fundamentally good, and the purpose of government is not to restrain the evil impulses of people. Obviously, when it happens, you want to punish and try to correct. But the goal of government is to give people the backstop, the necessary platform, the floor, the starting point. And so conservative thought now has been ascendant in the United States. Liberal thought in the United States basically controlled this country from 1933 with the installation of Franklin Roosevelt after the 32 elections until 1981 when Reagan came in. And conservative thought has pretty much ruled the United States from 1981 till today, including, I would argue, during the Clinton administration. And conservative thought has, by and large, particularly when it comes to things like trade, brought us just a wonderful collection of things. See, they say we don't want government, but they do believe that there must be some kind of restraining force. There must be, to quote Russell Kirk, you know, order and classes in society. So if you don't have government, who's in charge? Well, multinational corporations and very wealthy people. That's the ideal in conservative thought. You know, they're going to rail, for example, against the Supreme Court ruling saying that the EPA has the right to, on behalf of we the people. We the people elect our officials, and they create this organization, the Environmental Protection Agency, to protect the environment and do what we want done. And the conservatives will say, oh, no, you nameless, faceless bureaucrats are going to be regulating how much carbon dioxide you can emit. You don't want that? Well, yeah, actually, we do want that. That's why we created an EPA. But it's incredible how they're just, you know, freaking out because they don't believe that government should restrain people, except when it comes to do with sexual activity or whether or not they're going to have an abortion or if they decide to desecrate a flag or something. Then the government should be in your face fast with a gun. But otherwise, no. When it comes to commerce, if it comes to throwing things in the atmosphere that we all may have to breathe or that might change the atmosphere, that should be regulated by private industry. That should be up to the so-called private market. And the results of this are pretty dramatic. The results of 26 years of conservative thinking in the United States, particularly economically. But we see it in social policy. We see it right across the board. This foundational conservative notion that there must be a restraining force, but that the appropriate restraining force isn't one that's under the control of the maximum number of people. Because you can't trust democracy, after all, in conservative thinking. Government, you know, reflecting the will of the people, that's a dangerous thing. Instead, we've got to have governance by a small order of very wealthy and powerful people known as multinational corporations and the rich. And I'll tell you right after this break exactly what the results of that are. 27 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
In broadcasting, 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. By the way, the reason why John Locke, the original liberal philosopher, is so significant and relevant to us as Americans, even though he was writing in the latter part of the 1600s in England, is that his second treatise on government contained the phrase life, liberty, and estate. And elsewhere he referred to it as life, liberty, and property. And, you know, as the justification for government. The government is created in order to preserve and maintain life, liberty, and private property, essentially. And Thomas Jefferson looked at that and said, yeah, we'll take this a step further. Because by that time, the Enlightenment had grown a little and matured a little. This was, you know, nearly 100 years later that Jefferson wrote the Declaration of Independence, and he changed it to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And said, no, that's why this country is being founded. We're going to be even more radical than John Locke was. So anyhow, what conservative economics have brought us? Just a couple of quickies here. This from today's Wall Street Journal. The headline, China plans a U.S. spending spree. Yep, they're going to buy $2 billion worth of soybeans and $500 million worth of cotton. The Chinese are buying raw materials from us, as well as machinery, electronics, and other things. They're basically... we have gone from they're basically buying the raw materials necessary to make the things that they will then sell back to us. We have gone from being the world's largest manufacturer and exporter of finished goods in 1980, the year that Ronald Reagan was elected, and we had been that for a long time. In 26 years of conservative, insane trade policies and insane conservative economics, we've gone from being the world's largest importer of raw materials and exporter of finished goods. We brought in the soybeans, we brought in the cotton, and we shipped out the clothing, the Levi's. Now we export the cotton to China and we import the Levi's. We don't make Levi's in the United States anymore, at least not that name brand. I remember when they closed their last factory. I wrote about it in my book, Unequal Protection, The Rise of Corporate Dominance and the Theft of Human Rights. So there's that story in today's Wall Street Journal. Here's another one. This is from the San Diego Union Tribune. North Canton, Ohio is the dateline. The Hong Kong company-based company that acquired Hoover, as in vacuum cleaners, earlier this year from Whirlpool Corp, said Monday it will close the main campus and some manufacturing operations of the vacuum cleaner business this fall, resulting in 750 job cuts in Ohio. Tektronix made a difficult decision after assessing its operation. Where are these jobs going? El Paso, Texas, and Juarez, Mexico. Circuit City, this is from Bloomberg. Circuit City to fire 3,400, hire less costly workers. This is why you will not find me shopping for my next computer in a Circuit City store. That's just a personal statement. It's, you know, I'm sure they sell great products, but Circuit City Stores, this Bloomberg. Circuit City Stores, the second largest U.S. electronics retailer after Best Buy Company, fired 3,400 of its highest paid hourly workers and will hire replacements willing to work for less. The company said it's eliminating jobs that paid well above market rates. Those who were fired can apply for the lower pay, company spokesman Bill Camino said today. He declined to give the wages of the fired workers or the new hires. I'm guessing he also declined to say what his paycheck was. And this from the New York Times, David K. Johnson. Income gap is widening, data shows. Income inequality grew significantly in 2005, with the top 1% of Americans receiving their largest share of national income since 1928. The top 10% also reached a level of income not seen since before the Depression. The gains went largely, however, to the top 1%, those whose incomes rose to an average of more than $1.1 million each. The top 1% saw an increase in the year 2005 of $139,000 per person. The new data shows that the top 300,000 Americans, 300,000 people, collectively, had as much income as the bottom 150 million Americans combined. Per person, the top group received 440 times as much as the average person, and the bottom half earned nearly doubling the gap from 1980. Now, as I've said many times, I have no problem with people doing very well. Thank you very much. And I believe that if we're going to have an economy and we're going to have a functioning economy, it has to function in a way, as Teddy Roosevelt pointed out, as Franklin Roosevelt pointed out, as Abraham Lincoln pointed out, and certainly as the founders, none of whom left huge dynasties or estates. The first millionaire in today's terms was in 1790 in the United States. The first serious robber barons, the first dynastic families emerged in the 1880s in the United States, in large part as a result of government welfare. The railroad, huge railroad giveaways, which produced the railroad, what in today's dollars would be billionaires. And that came about as a result of the Civil War. But the bottom line is that the economy should serve society as a whole, as well as the individuals in it, not just the individuals in it. And that's the central cleavage between Republican/conservative/libertarian, Republicans who want to smoke dope and get laid thought, and progressive and liberal thought, period. Tom in Stratford, Connecticut. Hey, Tom, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. Just wanted to make a comment. You had asked for the origins of conservatism in this country, and thanks to you, I've been doing some reading. I started with Ketchum's biography of Madison and went on to Levi's Origins of the Bill of Rights. Mm-hmm. And what I've concluded, mostly tried to think this through myself, is that the preamble to the Declaration is the real promise of our government. And
yes.
the Constitution is the blueprint to deliver on that promise. Well, when they said we're all created equal, to me, and I know I don't know the whole history of this, but that sounds like individual sovereignty. And if we each start out as king, first of all, interestingly aside, we start out with the default of all rights, and we only surrender them through our collective consent.
Let me just stop you right there, because you're going down a road that neither Hobbes nor Locke went down, and Jefferson didn't go down. That although each person is created equal, each is a sovereign. Hobbes was actually the first philosopher to argue that we are all created equal. And therefore, he not only founded modern conservative thought, but he also created the foundation for modern liberal thought.
Okay.
But he thought that equality was what produced the natural warlike state of humans.
Mm.
He saw that as a problem.
Mm.
Then Locke came along and said, yeah, we're all created equal, and that's a good thing. And Jefferson went forward saying, yes, that's a good thing, and the job of government. And really, it should be equality of opportunity, not equality of, you know, because all of them acknowledge the fact that people have different physical and mental abilities.
Right.
They're born into different circumstances. I mean, you know, nobody is arguing that all, in the Marxist sense, that all people, you know, from each according to his ability, to each according to his needs.
Right.
Nobody's
right.
arguing that.
Right. In any case, what I concluded, I still think there's a lot to the idea of individual sovereignty, and I do think it holds many things that both conservatives and liberals would not like. But what I got from that was, if that's the case, and if we're collectively yielding our sovereignty to form a government, then any time the government acts, it does two things. It takes away freedom, and it takes our money to do that. Those things in and of themselves aren't necessarily things that we want. And I think that is the
well,
that's
no,
what
the
I
side
think
of that, though. Yeah, I you know, I don't disagree with you. However, if the government is doing that because we have asked it to, in other words, if we decide that we want to have mm-hmm. a police department protecting us, and
right.
we are going to tax ourselves to pay for the salaries of those people, if we decide that we want to have a highway system so we can travel, and we want to have stoplights, and we're going to pay for that, that's, you know, that's the government acting. It's reducing our freedom. You have to stop for the red light.
Oh, sure.
And we all agree that we want it.
Yeah.
And, you know, and that's the optimal state of government.
Mm-hmm.
And the argument between conservatives and liberals is, you know, where do you draw the lines? And the extreme conservatives, the libertarians mm-hmm. and the Randians, the objectivists would say, you know, we shouldn't even have public roads.
Sure.
They should all be privately owned. And that's, you know, that's the extreme end of it. Tom, good point. Interesting point. Thank you very much for the call. I've got to move along here, though. Steve, we've got a lot of calls. Steve in Mountain View, California. Hey, Steve, what's on your mind today?
Hey, good morning, Tom. Yeah, I think the comment about conservatives and liberals having a different view about whether people are inherently evil or inherently good, I think people in general view other people according to their own understanding of themselves. And so people who
that's
haven't
right.
done any meditation or have never looked at themselves very carefully tend to think people outside are evil and are a threat to them, whereas people who have spent some time in meditation and looked at who they actually are understand that people are, in fact, good by nature.
Yeah. One of the things I've found really interesting is how people assume humans behaved before modern civilization. If you ask most conservatives, were Native American tribes before the arrival of Europeans in a constant state of warfare, they will say, yes, absolutely, and I can prove it. If you ask most liberals, were Native American tribes in a constant state of warfare before the arrival of Europeans, they'll say, no, it was the exception rather than the rule. They developed things like lacrosse as a game to settle conflict, and I can prove it. And what it does is it reflects this fundamental difference in worldview that you know, Hobbes said, evil and war is the natural state of man. Locke said, you know, peace and harmony is the natural state of man. And you know, that and what, just like you said, what we do is we overlay our assumptions about how everybody, about how we are, on everybody else, and vice versa. Yeah. So yeah, good point, Steve. Thanks a lot for the call and for the point. It's well made. I think it also highlights why conservative morality is typically about regulating private behavior, who's sleeping with whom and in what position, or who's smoking what. And liberal morality is typically about public behavior. Are there hungry among us? Are there homeless among us? Are there sick among us? If so, we must do something or we're not moral. And it again comes back to that core notion of humans. 45 minutes after.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, the No Boring Zone, on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Back 9.5 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you, exposing the con and conservative. According to Forbes, Circuit City's chairman and CEO Philip J. Schoonover pulls in $2.17 million last year. Not too shabby. So they're firing their highly paid workers and replacing them with cheaper workers. Somehow it just doesn't seem American to me. But it is consistent with the Reagan-esque worldview. And, you know, to the extent that that has become the American worldview over the last 26 years, I guess it's just right in line with everything else, tragically. Andre in Columbia, South Carolina, listening on WOIC. Hey, Andre, welcome to the program.
Hey, how you doing?
I'm great, but I'll get better, Andre. Thanks for asking. What's up?
Well, I wanted to make a comment on this election. I'm a black South Carolinian. And, you know, it's occurred to me that in 2000 and 2004, during those presidential elections, over 50,000 black Americans were disenfranchised for the vote for nothing other than being black.
Yeah, and Florida alone, and probably two or three times that many in Ohio.
Right, and for no other reason. Some of these people served in the armed forces. How can any American trust a party that would disenfranchise another American? I don't get it at all. And I also don't get why the Democratic Party isn't coming back and prosecuting those people that did that.
Well, yeah, I absolutely agree with you, and why they aren't raising holy hell about it, and why there's not more talk about it in the media, and for that matter, why there isn't a more ongoing talk about what happened in New Orleans in the media. And I think that to some extent, it's we can lay some of this at the floor of institutionalized racism in this country in the media as well as everybody as well as everywhere else, and also, you know, certainly the power and influence of the Republican Party. The good news, Andre, although the people who are disenfranchising people were not specifically being prosecuted in Ohio, two people have been sent to jail, have received prison sentences so far for the theft of the 2004 election in Ohio. A third looks like they may be indicted. So, you know, there is some activity, but the NAACP lawsuit in Florida, for example, you know, still going on. I believe that there's still a restraining order against Jeb Bush down there, even though he's no longer governor, or against the governor's office, let's say. Yeah, good point, you know, well said. Thank you very much for the call. Yeah, this is the Republican Party, the modern Republican Party. They want their prosecutors, this is all the federal prosecutors is all about, they want them to prosecute, quote, voter fraud, end quote, which means voting while black, by and large. They wanted them to go after ACORN, which is an organization that goes into minority areas and registers voters. But they didn't want them prosecuting election fraud. That would be like what happened in Ohio. That would be like what happened in Florida. No, we don't want election fraud prosecuted. We want voter fraud prosecuted. That was the mantra of the Republican Party. Pete in Greeley, Colorado, listening on 760 AM. Hey, Pete, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom, I just wanted to say on your comments on Hobbs and Locke that I think the Republicans have turned Hobbs completely on his head. And that today they're saying that man is really inherently good. Look, just trust us with our economic policies and with our trickle down economics. It's sort
Well, really, what they've done is they've restored us to the divine right of kings. I mean, the whole notion and the first, by the way, the first time that England said no more was James the first son, Charles the first, and then he got overthrown by Oliver Cromwell, if I'm remembering my British history right, and that would be in the 1630s or thereabouts, or 1640s. When that happened, that was the first time in the history of European kingdoms that a king who claimed that he ruled by the divine right of kings, in other words, by God's ordination, had been overthrown by the people, and the people said, no, wait a minute, we want to have a say in our government. Now, what they got was a Puritan theocracy for the next 11 years, which, you know, wasn't the very best thing. But I would submit to you that what the Republicans are doing is they're hearkening back to pre-Charles I. They're hearkening back to the notion of kingdom, where the king said, yes, the intrinsic nature of humans is evil, except for the royal family.
Yeah, there's an exception in there somewhere in their philosophy that they're not telling us about.
Yeah,
you know,
well, and that's it.
I think that trickle-down economics is a big utopian ideal that never gets described as that. But if you think about it, it's a condescending promise that just sounds like a bad plumbing problem.
Yeah, you're right. And the one thing that trickle-down economics always produces is a lot of peons. And here we are. Pete, thanks a lot for the call. John in Denver. Hey, John, what's up?
Hey, Tom, how are you doing?
Tom, great. What's up?
All right. Hey, thanks for what you do. I appreciate your honesty and a little bit of logic and sanity on the radio. I just wanted to say to all those Ayn Rand types that might be listening in, you know, the deregulation people, business never regulates itself unless it's about making a profit.
Mantra after me. Enron.
Yeah, exactly. If business would regulate itself, 9/11 would never happen. And what I see from that is, you know, I'm not an aeronautic engineer. I'm just a small building contractor. But I know that for less than the price of one round-trip international airplane ticket, I could have put a secure door on those cockpits for them.
In fact, it was proposed back in the 1970s. I mean, this was, and thanks for the call. This was, when the first hijackings to Cuba happened, the Democrats in Congress said, let's require the airlines to basically lock those doors. That's what Israel was already doing on El Al. It's what the European airlines were doing. They said, let's simply make these doors unbreakable. And the airline said, no, you're talking about a door that right now costs us a few $100s, and you're going to make that door cost thousands. And when you amortize that across the cost of thousands of airplanes, we're talking millions and millions of dollars, and we don't want to spend the money. And because the airlines shot down that legislation back in the 1970s, when there was an attempt by government to regulate the airline industry in order to make it safer and harder to hijack an airplane, you can track directly from that idea of deregulation, that idea of, oh, we can't have a nanny state, we can't have government interfering. You can track right from that to guys with box cutters taking out pilots. I mean, it's a direct line. And thank you for pointing it out. I wish more people would more often. I probably should myself more often. Of course, it requires the assumption that it was all about guys with box cutters, but we'll go with that story for the moment. Although it does need to be investigated. 57 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Up next, attention deficit disorder.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Talk radio for the rest of us. This is Air America Radio. Radio proudly presents the Tom Hartman Program, defending America from the weapons of mass deception.
Welcome back to the second hour of our program. Tom Hartman here with you. Back in the late 60s, I had a pretty good friend back in East Lansing, and about 4 years ago, her mother died, and she was living out in New York State, and we would see, you know, each other every year. An old friend of ours, Java Man, would have his annual party, and we'd all get together, you know, all of us who used to hang out back in at the Student Union Building and SDS and whatnot. Anyhow, to make a long story short, her mother died, and she was very sad about that, which is a normal response. But she was having a tough time dealing with it, and she went to see her doc, who put her on, I'm not going to name the brand name, but one of the selective serotonin reuptake inhibitor drugs, the SSRI drugs, this new family of antidepressants that include, recognizable brands like Prozac and Wellbutrin and whatnot, put her on one of these drugs. And here it is now 4 years later, maybe 5 years later, And she's still on it. Because apparently she's unwilling to deal with withdrawal from it. And I, along with many of her mutual friends, would say that she is not the same person she was 6 years ago. And we'd like her back, you know, our friend, our mutual friend. Shankar Vedantam, writing in the L.A. Times, the Washington Post, up to 20 diagnoses, depression diagnoses scrutinized. This is in today's paper. Up to 25% of people whom psychiatrists would currently diagnose as depressed may only be reacting normally to stressful events such as divorces or losing a job, according to a new analysis that reexamined how the standard diagnostic criteria were used. But the antidepressant drug market, $12 billion in sales last year. The new study found that extended periods of depression-like symptoms are common in people who have been through life stresses such as divorce or a natural disaster and don't necessarily constitute illness. Isn't this common sense? And if somebody needs something to get through, you know, something over a short period of time, I mean, there are substances that are not designed for people to use for their entire lives because they have a neurochemical imbalance and need to have their serotonin levels regulated. Now, yeah, I suppose I should, you know, put a caveat emptor here. I'm not dispensing psychiatric or psychological advice. I'm at the very bottom of the food chain. I was on the roster of unlicensed psychotherapists in Vermont, which would allow me to hang out a shingle. And I was a guest faculty member at Goddard College for a while. And the founder and executive director of a residential treatment facility for emotionally disturbed kids and the school, School for Kids with Attention Deficit Disorder, the Hunter School. HunterSchool.org is the website on the web in New Hampshire. And I've written 7 books on the topic of attention deficit disorder, education, learning disabilities. But I'm not a psychiatrist or a psychologist, so I'm not, nor am I a Scientologist. I am not representing myself as any of the above. But here we see, this is another follow-on story from MSNBC. And it, frankly, this, you know, we started out the program today talking about the wonders of the free market as opposed to government. What happens when government goes away and an absolutely unregulated laissez-faire free market takes over? Well, one of the things that happens is they get inside your head. We talked with Bill McKibben at some length in some ways about this yesterday in terms of consumer culture. But, you know, they get inside, and we interviewed the author of a book a few weeks ago about how our consumer culture is even infantilizing us, you know, making us behave as if we're children. The message of our culture, of mother culture, is, to quote Dan Quinn, is you are the most important person in the world, right? And this is a message that basically turns adults into children. Well, you know, I am very concerned that we are medicalizing a lot of things that should not be medical conditions. Here's another story. The use of drugs to treat attention deficit hyperactive disorder, or ADHD, has more than tripled worldwide since 1993. Spending on the drugs rose ninefold. One in 25 children in the United States is taking medication for ADHD. Now, I would be the first to acknowledge that there are some people, and some children for that matter, who are so dysfunctional in this society that they need alternatives. And frankly, I think the best alternatives are things like alternative school environments or homeschool environments or things like that. But those are not options for many families. And the downside of failure is huge. Kids who can't function in our public schools, and I would argue that our schools, by and large, are not designed in a way that is universally user-friendly. It's particularly not friendly for ADD kids. Kids who can't function in those schools, you know, the downside of failure can be a lifetime of disaster. And if medication can prevent them from failing, then I'm not universally opposed to it. Let me just put that right out there. This is not an anti-medication screed. But speaking as the father of a kid who was diagnosed with ADHD, as somebody who's, you know, one of my brothers was diagnosed with it and was on Ritalin for years, somebody who probably would have been diagnosed with it if I wasn't instead earlier diagnosed as gifted, and so I was put in these fast-track programs literally in the second grade, and as a consequence of that, you know, could do pretty much as much as I wanted as fast as I could. And, it, you know, this was all because Sputnik went up, and Eisenhower freaked out and threw all kinds of money in education and said, let's identify the next generation of scientists. And I think, frankly, that saved my life. But then, you know, within 15 years or so, we were off to the Vietnam War, and all that funding for gifted kids special education went away. We're investing less than 0.1% of federal education dollars on gifted kids, and, you know, and which is not to say that we shouldn't be investing money in kids who are struggling, in learning disabled kids, but it's like, you know, where are our priorities? And instead, we've got a lot of kids who are really smart, sitting in class, bored, silly, and acting out because they're bored and they're being given pharmaceuticals. And I have I have some substantial concerns about that. I think that there is a fundamental difference in the wiring of some of us. Back in the late 80s, early 90s, when one of our kids was diagnosed with ADHD and told that he would never basically amount to anything and should learn how to be an auto mechanic, and his dream of being a marine biologist he should just throw away because ADD kids don't do well in college, is what the psychologist told him in front of Louise and I, in front of his parents. This, one of our children who's finishing his master's degree right now, by the way, in ecology, a field related to marine biology. But back when that happened, I sat down and thought, you know, what could this be? These three cardinal characteristics of impulsivity, easy distractibility, and a need to have high levels of arousal, of stimulation. How could this be useful? And one night I was laying in bed reading a Scientific American to try and get myself to sleep, because I'm a really light sleeper, and if I read something really boring at night, it puts me to sleep, and Scientific American maybe one time out of, you know, nine times out of ten, the articles are really nice, boring articles. And I was reading this article about the genetics of wheat and rice, and they talked about how the agricultural revolution changed everything 10,000 years ago. We went from being hunter-gatherers to farmers, and I thought, gee, if I was a hunter-gatherer, I'd need to be distractible. I'd need to be noticing everything around me in the forest, because that flash of light over there might be my lunch. It might be the rabbit that's going to be my lunch, or it might be the bear that wants to make me its lunch. So that scanning behavior in the classroom becomes an asset in the hunting-gathering society. That impulsivity, quick decision-making. If you're chasing a rabbit through the forest and a deer runs by, you can't sit down and do a risk-benefit analysis. You've got to make an instant decision. That impulsivity would be an asset in the hunting-gathering world. And that need for high stimulation, the person who wakes up in the morning and says, you know what sounds like fun? Going out there where there's things that want to eat me as much as I want to eat them and finding lunch. That person would be ideally adapted. Somebody who had the opposite characteristics would be a failure in a hunting-gathering society, but they would succeed in a farming society where they're picking bugs off plants all day long, very, very focused, you know, not willing to take risks and not easily distracted. And so I came up with this theory of hunters and farmers and wrote a book about it, ADD, A Different Perception, and Time Magazine did a story on it, and that led to six more books. But anyhow, bottom line here is big business taking over psychology to the point that it's harming America. 16 minutes past here.
In broadcasting, this is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Sometimes I feel a little mad, but don't you know that no one alive can always be an angel? When things go wrong, I seem to be bad.
Or when you got ADD.
I'm just a soul whose intentions are good. Oh, Lord, please don't let me be misunderstood.
Yes. Are you depressed? Are you impulsive? Is your blood pressure too high? How about your lipids? What's going on with your cholesterol? Here, this is from USA Today by Rita Rubin. Pfizer, faced with a potential loss of billions of dollars as patients with high cholesterol switch from Lipitor to generic Zocor. Pfizer, the manufacturer of Lipitor, has been helping doctors wage a letter-writing campaign to slow the tide. Isn't that sweet? The drug company wants to make sure that you are buying the most expensive version of its product. Well, of course, they're in the business of making money. Pfizer sent doctors a CD containing two letters, one to health plans and one to pharmacists. The letters urged that switching from Lipitor to a generic statin, quote, for cost reasons alone will undermine the clinical judgment that went into the decision to prescribe Lipitor for this patient, end quote. Say what? I thought I prescribed the drug, not the brand. Or at least that's how I'd be thinking. Now, again, as I said in my original caveat, I'm not a physician, but if I'm prescribing a drug and it goes by five different names because there's four generic versions of it and they're all the exact same identical drug and they're at wildly different prices, it seems to me like I'd be acting in my patient's best interest if I made sure that they got the cheapest version, not the most expensive one, assuming that the quality was identical in all of them, which is the purpose of the Food and Drug Administration. And I think that in that regard, that's actually one of the things that they do quite well. Thank you very much. As Sidney Wolf, director of Public Citizen Health Research Group, said, he says they're using doctors as a human shield to protect them from losing business. He says, I'd say it's unethical. Generic statins, Pravastatin and Lovastatin, are also available. Helped Express Scripts, this is a pharmacy benefits management company, save its client health plans $126 million last year, according to Ed Weisbart with Express Scripts. $126 million they saved their patients. Well, you know what that means. That's $126 million that Pfizer didn't make. We can't have that. To what extent, and I'll tell you, you know, when I first wrote in 1992, as I recall, I think it was published in 93. I'd have to go back and look because I think it was the Time magazine was in 1993 when they did the cover story on ADD that had a third of a page article, a sidebar article in it called Hail the Hyperactive Hunter. Tom Hartman has this theory that it's that ADD is not really a pathology, except perhaps in extreme cases, that in fact it's just a neurological difference that would highly adapt people to living in a hunting-gathering society, but isn't so useful in our modern post-agricultural industrial society because the skill set of picking bugs off plants hour after hour after hour is the same as the skill set of putting a bolt on a screw hour and hour after hour after hour, which is the same as the skill set of sitting in a boring classroom and learning how to memorize dates hour after hour after hour. That these kids are highly interactive. They need to learn by doing. They need to learn by teaching. I saw a classroom in Taiwan back in the late 70s, early 80s when I was writing about this stuff. I saw a classroom in Taiwan where the teacher stood up and the first 5 minutes of the class, and keep in mind this was in Chinese. I had somebody there telling me what was going on, but, you know, so I didn't get every word. I didn't even get any words. But anyway, she stood up and for the first 5 minutes, she summarized the one-hour lesson. And you think about it, any one-hour class you've ever had in your life could be summarized in 5 minutes. You may not understand it, but you can summarize long division. You can summarize quadratic equations in 5 minutes. You know, the concept. So she did that. And then she looks around the room and she says, now, who already knew this or who understands this now? And this is a class of about 40 kids. They were probably, I don't know, 10, 11, 12 years old. And six or seven of them stand up. I understand it. And she says, great, now you teach the others. And groups would form around the kids who were standing. And the kids who were standing were the teachers, and the kids who were sitting were the students. And when the kids who were sitting got it, they would stand up and participate in the teaching along with the teaching kids. And you could see learning moving across that classroom like a wave. And the teacher's job then was to go around and basically be a consultant to all these kids who were teaching to make sure that they had it right. and to answer questions that they had. And by the end of that hour, every kid in that classroom was standing, and there wasn't a single bored kid in that classroom. It was one of the most ideally suited classrooms I've ever seen to both those very focused farmer kids and those very distractible hunter kids. And then I discovered that this is something that's been around in education for a long, long time. It's called peer-based learning, and it's something that we did in the United States for 150 years in what we used to call one-room schoolhouses, where the kids taught each other as much as the teacher taught them. This is the history of education in the United States. Why can't we do simple stuff like this? You know, the Socratic teaching method. Instead of saying, you don't fit into the classroom, take this pill. It just, you know, seems like there should be a rational middle ground here. Get your thoughts on this and continue the rant, as it were. Perhaps explain a bit more about attention deficit disorder right after this. 27 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Truth and common sense in broadcasting for a change.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
Minutes past the hour, listener-supported radio. It's the Tom Hartman Program, supported by you, our listeners, listening for our sponsors and letting them know that you're listening, like Sacred Grounds Coffee, sacredgroundscoffee.com, Small Dog Electronics, smalldog.com, the Organic Wine Company, 1-888 Eco Wine, Purina One Natural Blends, 1-866-380-MEOW, and the local sponsors on your local radio station. Let them know you're listening. Let them know that you'll buy their products when it's time. You know, when you need to buy a new car, you'll patronize that car dealer. Or if you need to go out to dinner, you'll go to that restaurant and do so. Well, that's, you know, you don't have to write a check to support this radio program to the program, but you can support our sponsors. That's how commercial radio works, and I think it's a fine thing. Our telephone number, 1-866-303-2270. If you want to drop into our live chat room, go to TomHartman.com. And click live chat. It'll get you over there. There'll soon be a link over at Air America Radio as well to get you there, airamerica.com. Blueberry Pickin in the chat room says, this is really funny. You know, I was telling the story about in 1992, the Time magazine doing the article about me and my theories and my book, my first book on ADD, ADD Different Perception. And Blueberry says, Tom, in 1992, I decided to re-enroll in university for neuropsychology after reading a really cool article in Time magazine. Until today, I didn't realize it was your article. I'm honored. I am honored. Jeff in San Francisco, California. Hey, Jeff, what's on your mind today?
Well, hey, Tom. I think this is an absolutely fascinating subject, and I am a licensed clinical psychologist. And
I salute you. You're way up the food chain for me.
The Cadillac of mental health degrees, as I've heard it called by friends of mine.
Yeah.
But anyway, so I've gotten these credentials in part because I'm really interested in this very topic, and I like to be able to speak about it with a little bit of credibility. And I personally am very dismayed by the medicalization of human problems that this society has moved into, and the way that, you know, something like, you know, boy, ADD, I think I'm in the same boat as you. If I was, when I was younger, if I had not, you know, been enrolled in an alternative school and gotten the kind of help I had gotten when I was younger, I think it could have been very likely I would have gotten fed some pills and sort of boxed away like a lot of other kids. And
a brother,
you know,
hunter.
It's so true, and I think just as a side note about that, experimentation with different teaching methods is just, that's the cure for this so-called disease, you know, which I don't consider a disease at all. And here's another point as well. I mean, I'm not anti-drug or anti-medicine by any means. I mean, I'm a libertarian, as I've called before, and I'm very much, you know, for the use of drugs for any purpose people feel the need, you know, but You know, I think mental illness per se is not an illness at all. I don't consider it a disease. I think it's kind of the, you know, literalization of a metaphor.
Jeff, we can both acknowledge that there are times, I mean, if you consider that the brain is an organ just like the liver is, or the heart is, you know, there are times when it doesn't function properly and it is appropriate to intervene.
Well, of course. Well, look, I intervene all the time with human problems. I mean, that's what I do. People are having trouble, getting a divorce or feeling blue for no particular reason. That's what I do. I'm all about intervention. But a couple authors, maybe real quick for you to look into, is a guy named Thomas Zaz, S-Z-A-S-Z, and he wrote a book called The Myth of Mental Illness, and he really has a lot of the same feelings I do, that this pathologization of human problems is just a really,
In fact, he starts with that study. Where was it done? Was it the University of Minnesota where they did the study where they broke people into three groups, those who got therapy, those who went exercising because the therapist said, you've got to exercise before I'll put you in the study, and they never had therapy, and the group who just showed up and sat in the waiting room, and the group who exercised got the optimal outcome. And you know, there was a variety of forms of therapy, including pharmaceutical therapy, and still the people who exercised had the most positive outcome.
Well, you know, I'm not aware if he had anything to do with that study, but that makes a lot of sense to me, frankly.
Yeah. Yeah.
Here's another thing I wanted to, I just wanted to say, I think also in terms of, you know, big business, and absolutely big business is behind the push for taking pills for every problem, because you can't really commodify therapy, you can't really commodify human relationships, which is all I'm selling, you know, when I work with
people.
But that's
what the DSM attempts to do, and that's what psychiatry is all about. The Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of the American Psychiatric Association, it's a checklist now.
Absolutely.
It's, you know, everybody's analyzed based on mathematics.
Yes. Here's a point I wanted to inject in this. The government is very complicit in pushing this pill-based, medicalized view of human problems as well. If you look at the people that staff the FDA and the National Institutes of Medicine and National Institutes of Drug Abuse, they're very much stacked into funding, and it's all about what studies are funded. The studies that are funded are ones that focus on drugs, because you can measure drugs. You can, you know, measure.
No, I absolutely agree with you, Jeff. And the solution to that is to end the revolving door, because a lot of people are using government as a stepping stone into private industry, or they're stepping out of private industry, going into government, you know, changing government policy, and then going back into private industry, and ultimately it corrupts both. I absolutely, you know, well said. Thank you for the call, Anna in Northampton, Mass. Hey, Anna, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. Well, I'm depressed because Pfizer isn't making as many profits. Is there a pill for that?
Well, if you're depressed, they've got a pill for you.
Okay. I was going to say, I think the problem that you're talking about, that the article in the Times, the study was based on, is I think it isn't as much a problem with the DSM-4. I'm a clinical social worker, by the way. I think it does, there is a specific section for, say, bereavement or, you know, life changes that sort of, that's not even an official diagnosis on the first axis. That's sort of other, you know, life events. And
you know
beyond
the word that's
that,
missing from
person,
the DSM. Do you know the word that's missing from the DSM? I'm the last one that I actually, you know, went through and spent any time reading was 3R. So you can tell it's been a few years since I was in this. But I'm assuming this is true of the DSM-4 as well. Is the word normal doesn't exist?
Abnormal, but not normal. No, you're absolutely right. But I think beyond that, there's adjustment disorder, say if bereavement, you know, lasts a long time or someone is adjusting to a new phase of life. So I think, and beyond that is clinical depression. So I think it might be in the practitioners that with the medical-based model, you know, you can see a psychiatrist for 15 minutes and they're supposed to understand your whole life. I mean, I'm reluctant to give a diagnosis after, you know, 2 or 3 weeks of hour-long sessions with people. So I think...
Right. But if you are a psychiatrist who are prescribing the majority of these pharmaceuticals or a GP, the insurance companies are telling you, you've got 15 minutes with that person and then they're out of there. And you've got to make a diagnosis and you got to write a prescription and you got to come up with, and it's got to be, you know, and number 007 on the, or 043 on the table so that we know how to pay it or whether to contest it and everything else. No,
exactly.
good point and well made, Anna. Thank you very much. Julius in Detroit. Hey, Julius.
How are you, Tom? Hello.
Fine. What's up?
Good. I just want to thank you for, I'm going to call it your big spirituality, because I just left my a school where I used to work. I had to give it up because of some of the same things that you talk about in your article. And I mainly want to ask you, which of the books did you describe the hunter-gatherer philosophy?
I've written 7 books about attention deficit disorder. The 2 best are the very first one, which is called ADD, A Different Perception. That's the original Hunter in a Farmer's World book. And the most recent one, which is called The Edison Gene, in which one of the world's leading experts in genetics actually did a study where they pulled blood samples from 300 discrete groups around the world. This was in combination with Yale University, University of California, and Beijing University, and did an analysis of the DR, the DT, the dopamine transporter genes, and the DR2 and DR4 genes, and they're looking at the 7th and the 11th allele, and what they found was that there is a genetic basis for ADD, and that in hunting-gathering societies, it's overrepresented, and in highly agricultural societies, it's underrepresented. In other words, I was right. I was trying to come up with a metaphor, and now science has demonstrated that actually it was right. So the first book, ADD, A Different Perception, the last book, The Edison Gene, and then there's a bunch of kind of how-to and self-help books in the middle that are, they're not bad, but, you know, those are the very, very best. Mary in Peoria, Illinois. Hey, Mary, welcome to the program. We've got about a minute before we've got to take a break.
Okay, Tom. Hey, I really understand what you're saying about the medication thing. I'm a speech pathologist in the public schools here, and the alternative ways of teaching I think are wonderful, except I'm not really sure that No Child Left Behind is allowing us to do that.
I agree.
The teachers want to, but they have to teach the test.
That's right. We've got to get rid of No Child Left Behind.
Oh my God. No kidding. We really do.
I mean, what No Child Left Behind, the reason Jim Jeffords left the Republican Party was because of No Child Left Behind. And I talked with him and his staff about that at the time because I was writing a book, Unequal Protection. There's a chapter in there about this. And he said basically this was a law that was designed to increase the wealth of the test-making companies, which is a business, by the way, that one of George W. Bush's brothers is now in.
That's right.
It went from a $400 million industry to a $2 billion industry in 2 years.
That's right. They're given programs that they have to teach, and they want just anybody to be able to teach them.
Yeah. Standardized education, absolute cookie cutter. It's terrible, and we've got to do away with the No Child Left Behind law. It's destroying our schools. It's destroying the incentive of teachers. It's destroying kids, in my opinion, frankly. 45 minutes past the hour. Back with your calls, 866-303-2270. TomHartman.com. Drop into our live chat room if you'd like, right here on the Tom Hartman Radio Program.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Fair and slightly unbalanced. This is Air America Radio.
It's a vast liberal conspiracy. Take no imitations. The Tom Hartman Radio Program here with you. In just a moment, we're going to be talking to Victoria Jones with the Talk Radio News Service. First, just a real quick plug for an event that's going on for our listeners on Talk 1090 in Seattle. Jessica, you wanted to tell us about Dine for Darfur?
Yes, and today, April 3rd, you can go to www.chowfoods.com, and you can actually see the list of coffee shops, Pints for Darfur and Food for Darfur, and it lists all the restaurants in each area of Seattle if you live, and you can go, and 25% of that money will be donated to relief efforts in Darfur.
That's
only today.
And the website once again is?
www.chowfoods.com.
Child Foods.
Chow, C-H-O-W.
Oh, Chow.
Sorry.
C-H-O-W, Foods.
Yeah, ChowFoods.com.
Great. This is a great idea, and I wanted to put on a national program because I'd like to encourage people in other communities to consider doing this.
It's wonderful.
And also
if you're going to go out to eat or have a beer tonight, today's the day to do it.
In Seattle. Yeah.
In Seattle.
Or start something like this in your own local community. Jessica, thank you very much for that.
You can look it up online.
Okay.
Cool. Thanks, Tom.
Thank you. Good talking with you. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com in Washington, D.C., our accredited White House reporters and congressional reporters. And what, you even have credentials to get into the Pentagon, don't you, Victoria?
No, I actually don't have Pentagon credentials. No, I could get them, but I don't have them.
Harump.
Yeah, I know. I'm no longer worth talking to. I understand.
No. Do you really, there's a separate set of credentials required to get into the Pentagon? I didn't realize that. I thought that there was just kind of one security check that covered everything.
Oh, goodness me, no. No.
This is a very specialized business.
Very credentialized business. And in order to get your White House correspondent, you already have to have congressional credentials. You can't just get White House credentials. You already have to have
unless you're Jeff Gannon.
It's complicated.
Yeah, unless you're Jeff Gannon.
Unless you're Jeff Gannon, in which case the rules are a little bit different.
Yeah, he seems to have cut through some red tape in ways that have never quite been explained. Anyhow, what's going on in Washington, D.C. today, Victoria?
Well, I'm sitting outside the White House, and it's a beautiful day here, and I was earlier in the Rose Garden where it was baking hot. It's usually about 10 degrees hotter in the Rose Garden than anywhere else because it's a trap. And the president had what amounted to a press conference, although he didn't call it one, and he castigated the Democrats for the supplemental bill, basically, and said that they were withholding funding from the troops. This is a theme that we've heard reprised quite frequently by the president, even though the Democrats have said, no, well, that's exactly not what we're doing. We are, in fact, funding the troops. What we're doing is, on the contrary, we're also setting a limit on how long they should stay there, although the Democrats actually aren't making that argument particularly well, it seems to me.
Yeah, and in fact, the Doonesbury over the weekend was all about how basically the president, and this isn't how it was laid out in Doonesbury, but you could infer from it, that if the president were to veto this legislation and the Democrats were to say, okay, see you later, you know, we're going to go build windmills and put up solar panels and take us off oil dependency, that the troops would be fine, thank you very much. They only would be able to stay in Iraq for another 2 or 3 months, and then they'd have to come home, but they'd be fine, thank you very much.
Well, there is that argument that could be made, and a similar argument was put to Tony Fratto, Deputy White House Press Secretary, this morning, but he made the argument that the families would suffer with the lack of funding and that armaments and equipment would suffer. Of course, some people would say that armaments and equipment are suffering now, and that nevertheless the funds are urgently needed.
Yeah, yeah. And so, well, we'll see how this all plays out. Congress is in recess this week.
Oh, yes, they have to take a week off for Easter or spring. I presume they don't call it Easter because we don't have religious holidays here, but they probably call it spring break. But they're taking the House is taking 2 weeks off. The Senate's taking a week off. Why the House needs two, I don't really know. It's not like they do that much work.
Maybe Passover is interlaced in there. I'm not sure exactly what
it is. Maybe it's an extra week for Passover, a week for Passover and a week for Easter. It's all that eating.
Yeah, there you go. And, you know, my favorite part of the Seder, you have to down that entire glass of wine four times. When Congress comes back,
that gets very interesting because then we've got Alberto Gonzalez going up before the Senate because he has to go up next week on an entirely different matter, even though Patrick Leahy will be sitting in with the committee that oversees him, which I think is appropriations, I'm not sure. And then, of course, 1 week later, he'll go up before Senate Judiciary.
Right. And, you know, I'm just curious what you think is going to happen with these two bills that came out of the House and Senate in conference. Any sense of that? Is the conference work being done now during the break, or is that going to resume when Congress resumes?
I haven't heard very much about work being done while Congress is on break, actually. I think the work's going to be done when Congress resumes.
So
I could be wrong on that, but that's what I've heard.
So how long typically does it take for two bills to be reconciled in conference committee so that they can have a single piece of legislation to present to the president?
That's like how long is a piece of string. I mean, that entirely depends. You know, that really depends on how complicated the bill is. and how many issues they have to work out. Yeah, I mean, if it's an immigration bill, it could take all year, for example.
Yeah. Now, today, the Jerusalem, or actually maybe it was yesterday, the Jerusalem Post picked up the story that we were talking about a week or so ago that was in the Russian media, that the end of this week, Friday of this week, is when the Bush administration was planning on attacking Iran. I'm of the opinion that they won't, and we're going to ask this question to Madeleine Albright in the next hour.
The question was asked of White House Deputy Press Secretary Tony Fratto this morning by Andre, who works for the Russian media, and he was told flat out, it's all false.
Yeah. See, I think that this was the plan, and that the elections in November short-circuited it, and the Democrats getting a spine have caused Bush to back down. But, you know, who knows? Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Thanks, Victoria.
Thank you.
Good talking with you. 57 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program, your radio support group for We the People on Air America Radio.
Welcome back to the third hour of our program. Our intro music seems to have a little bit of a hiccup, but we're back, and we're here with you, and pleased to have you with us here on the Tom Hartman Program.
We're speaking with Madeleine Albright. She served as U.S. Secretary of State from 1997 to 2001, the first woman ever to hold the position. She's also held positions in the National Security Council on Capitol Hill and as the U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations. Secretary Albright, welcome.
Very good to be with you, Tom.
Great to have you with us. Your new book, The Mighty and the Almighty, Reflections on America, God, and World Affairs, is now out in paperback with a new afterword. And we spoke once before when the book first came out. I just want to reaffirm to you, I've had an opportunity to spend more time with it, what an extraordinary piece of literature this is, a really useful analysis of the, frankly, for lack of a better word, the religious interaction with politics around the world.
Well, thank you very much. I had a very interesting time writing it and learned a lot, which is kind of fun when you're writing a book. So thank you very much for your kind words.
Certainly. I'm curious, in the situation that we are facing right now in Iraq and Iran is not without a religious dimension, but, you know, it certainly goes a lot larger than that, starting with George Bush's attack of Iraq. Henry Kissinger, a couple of days ago, was quoted in many of the mainstream newspapers. I believe I saw it in the Wall Street Journal, although I may be wrong, in suggesting, and Kissinger, of course, on a more or less monthly basis, has been advising George W. Bush over the last few years, in suggesting that there is no possibility any longer of what might be referred to, and I'm sure I'm badly mangling his quote, but my recollection is there is no longer any possibility of a truly successful, victorious outcome in those kinds of terms. What's your take on the situation in Iraq, and if you're familiar with Dr. Kissinger's words, what he said?
Well, I agree with him and you. I mean, I think that we are in the worst possible place. And when I wrote the book, when it came out in hardback, it's now almost a year, I had in it something, you know, when you write a book, you want your predictions to be right. And in many cases, in this case, I actually hope it isn't, but I'm afraid it is. I said that Iraq is going to go down in history as the greatest disaster in American foreign policy. Because not only because of the chaos it's created in Iraq, but because of its unintended consequences. And I think that President Bush has been incapable now of defining what it is we are going, what he considers victory, or if victory is even possible. At first, it was this idea that Saddam Hussein would be overthrown and Iraq would be a model democracy. But the bottom line is, I believe in democracy, and I'm chairman of the board of the National Democratic Institute, but there are not a lot of neighbors or anybody that would look at Iraq and say, I want my country to look just like that. So it's not a model. I think that it is very hard to see what kind of stability Iraq might be able to provide to the region. So I think it is hard to define how the end point comes in terms of stating we have now accomplished what we wanted.
I understand that embedded in the legislation that authorizes funding for the continuation of the war right now, the legislation that President Bush is threatening to veto, is embedded a clause or paragraph that he very much wanted in there, which defines specific milestones or landmarks, one of which is the passage of the Iraqi oil or carbon law, which would give the American oil companies, three of them specifically, large American oil companies, the rights to something like 70% of Iraq's oil, or to, you know, to regulate and control that. Any thoughts on that?
Well, I think that the passage of the oil law itself is very important for the following reason, which is that there have been a lot of discussions about the fact that Iraq might split up. And one of the ways to hold it together is to try to distribute fairly the profits from the export of Iraqi oil. And it is supposed to be done on the basis of population. The problem is that Iraq hasn't had a census in ages, so that is going to be hard to do. I can't speak specifically to the American oil company aspect of it, but the oil law itself is a very important piece of legislation for the distribution of oil in Iraq, the oil revenues.
Right, but I guess the concern of its opponents is that rather than nationalizing oil, like in Saudi Arabia, for example, it essentially privatizes the oil, and then you end up with three autonomous regions competing with each other for which oil company is going to give them the better deal, and the price just is continually dropping.
Well, that is not supposed to happen, but, you know, as I say, there are many unintended consequences to what people are talking about.
As is often the case. Yeah. This leads, then, to a discussion of the possible partitioning of Iraq, something that Joe Biden has been suggesting for well over a year. Do you see that as a possible remedy? And if not, what do you think is the best solution to the situation in Iraq?
Well, what's interesting is I think Joe Biden's position has been somewhat misinterpreted. What he has specifically said not to partition. What he is for is a greater degree of autonomy for the regions as a way actually to keep the country together. So some kind of a more of a federal system, and a way of recognizing the Kurds in the north and the Shia in the south, and then a Sunni middle of some kind. Because, and I discussed this with him at a time I was testifying, and I think that the concern, if it really does fall apart into separate pieces, is that the Kurds in the north are a threat to, according to the Turks, to their territorial integrity, because they have a Kurdish population that would want to join what would be known as an independent Kurdistan. And there are Kurds in other countries in the region. So that kind of a displacement effect or knock-on effect is something that people are worried about. The Shia in the south, while they are Arabs and not Persians the way the Iranians are, there's a sense would increase the influence of Iran, which has grown incredibly as a result of this war. And the Sunni middle is kind of a mishmash of various tribes and things and is not so likely to be a unified peace. But if there really were a partition, I think it would create a lot of even greater chaos in the region. But what Biden is suggesting, a way of recognizing autonomy in order trying not to have it fall apart.
Is this more like the pre-Civil War United States, or perhaps the United States under the Articles of Confederation, where you have strong states and a weak federal government?
Something like that, you know, which ultimately people changed. But but the truth is that we could have given some better advice about we're pretty good at a federal system, and earlier had things developed in a different way, we might have been able to give better advice.
Yeah. We're talking with former Secretary of State Madeleine Albright, the author of a book which is now out in paperback, The Mighty and the Almighty. If I may change to Iran for a moment.
Sure.
I have two reports in front of me, one from the Jerusalem Post yesterday suggesting that on April 6th, Operation Bite is going to go into place, wherein the United States is going to, for a 12-hour period from 4 a.m. to 4 p.m., massively attack Iran's nuclear infrastructure. This was first reported a week or so ago in the Russian news services, and now the Jerusalem Post has picked it up in a fairly major story. I'm also seen at the same time Brian Ross and Christopher Isham reporting that Iran has tripled its ability to enrich uranium. What's your take on the whole situation with Iran? And then on top of that, just to further complicate things, Patrick Cockburn in The Independent is reporting this morning that a failed U.S. attempt to abduct two senior Iranian officials in a visit to northern Iraq was the starting pistol that led 10 weeks later to Iranians seizing 15 British sailors and Marines, and that until we acknowledge that, there's not going to be a resolution to that problem. And this is really turning into a mess.
Well, it definitely is a mess. And what has happened is that I do think that one of the unintended consequences of this, of the war in Iraq, is the increasing power of Iran. They are having more influence and power than they have had in centuries. And I think that that was not even vaguely calculated. I do think that there is a very growing and serious problem with Iran's lack of being able to certify that they are not involved in producing nuclear weapons material rather than just talking about peaceful uses. And there is an increasing conflict between Iran and the international community over that in terms of, and the Security Council of the UN has taken some fairly strong action. The second problem here, though, I have been very nervous about the fact that there are two aircraft carrier groups now in the Persian Gulf, and that they are doing military exercises closer and closer to Iran. And meantime, the Iranians also have a variety of exercises that there could be some military accident that then escalates out of control. There have also been reports, and they're totally unsubstantiated in terms of that there are plans to have an attack.
These Russian reports.
The Russian reports, and even, you know, generally stories about, are there plans for some kind of a military attack either by the U.S. or Israel? I imagine that what happens in any government, because I know this happened in ours, is you are always, you don't take the military option off the table, and there have to be plans. But from everything that I've read, there is no way to have an attack on the nuclear facilities that would actually get rid of the nuclear facilities in Iran. They are buried very deep. We don't know where all of them are. Some of them are amidst population centers. So a lot of people point back to the Israeli takeout of a nuclear reactor in Iraq. Osirik is successful, but that was one reactor, and everybody knew where it was.
In a remote location, too.
Right. And so the problem that I'm very worried about is that there's a lot of huffing and puffing, and that this will escalate to a point, and we don't need another war. We're not exactly doing well in the one that's going on. So I hope these things aren't true. I hope that the British are able to de-escalate on their naval personnel, and there's some indication this morning that they're beginning to talk. There are those who have written about the fact that there's this link, that if the Americans were to give back some of the Iranians that were captured in Iraq, it might change this, but I don't think it's wise to link those issues together.
Some are suggesting that had the Democrats not taken control of the House and Senate and essentially forced a change in U.S. foreign policy, that, or some pressure to change U.S. foreign policy, that we may well be attacking Iran right now. There was certainly all the rhetoric that was happening in August, September, and October last fall was the same kind of rhetoric that we were hearing leading up to the Iraqi invasion. And then it seemed to just vanish come more or less January. All of a sudden, the pundits and the talking heads stopped talking about the threat for Iran. Even the TV networks, which already had their logos up, you know, that Iran, the new threat, stopped using them. Do you think that one of the consequences of the elections was that the probability or possibility of George Bush moving on to Iran as the next country to attack has been minimized, or is that perhaps over-political, speculation?
No, well, first of all, I think that the signal that the American people gave in the November elections, I think, was finally heard in Washington. And so there are any number of things that have resulted as a fact of having a Democratic Congress. I think that it obviously has played a role, but other things have also played a role. One is the departure of Secretary Rumsfeld. And what is interesting is that Secretary Gates had written a study along with Zbigniew Brzezinski for the Council on Foreign Relations, which really pointed in a different direction in terms of dealing with Iran. Even though the Iraq Study Group recommendations were dismissed by President Bush, one of them was to begin to have some kind of discussions with Iran. I think that it must have had some effect within the system, because I agree with you. The language previously was, you could track it. It sounded really a lot like the justifications for Iraq. But I think the combination of the new Congress and the dismissal of Rumsfeld and the Iraq Study Group is a combination of those things, I think.
Right. A final and just very short question. Do you have a favorite in the 2008 elections, all the candidates out there?
I definitely do. I'm for Hillary Clinton. I think she is the best prepared person. And just discussing all the issues that are out there, the next president is going to have to hit the road running, and I really think that she is the best qualified for it, and I just think she's very smart, tough, and listens a lot. I think she would be terrific.
Mm-hmm. A woman as president, I think, might be a fine thing.
Well, that'd be very exciting.
Madeleine Albright, her new book, her new in paperback, The Mighty and the Almighty, Reflections on America, God, and World Affairs, former U.S. Secretary of State, former U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations. Madeleine Albright, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
Good speaking. 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. We'll be back with your calls and more news of the day right after this.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Fair and slightly unbalanced. This is Air America Radio.
Tom Hartman here with you, 26 minutes past the hour, and time for our conservative alert for the day. As indeed Bill O'Reilly. Cutter Mike, he says. Yes.
I served 29
you
years.
You started to dislike your own country.
Cutter Mike off. Goodbye. Cutter Mike off. Goodbye. Somewhere along the line, you decided to hate your own country. This a 29-year veteran of the U.S. Army and a woman who was teaching the Geneva Conventions. It's tragic. It's absolutely tragic. By the way, top 10 courses offered by Pat Robertson's Law School. Rules of faith-based evidence, getting God past the hearsay rule, voiding contracts with the devil, constitutional law, amending the First Amendment to combine for church and state. That's an interesting idea, sir. Back with your calls and small possibility we may have Cy Hirsch dropping in here right after the break. So stick around. 27 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman with you.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
Welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. The Washington State University's Vancouver Public Affairs Distinguished Lecture Series right across the river from us here in Portland is happening. And Cy Hirsch, Seymour Hirsch, the award-winning investigative journalist for The New Yorker and many other venues, is speaking tonight.
and fortunate enough to have him on the program here. Seymour Hersh, welcome. Actually, he's speaking tomorrow.
I was just thinking to myself, how am I going to get in two places at once?
Yeah, it's tomorrow. Okay, great. First of all, welcome to the program.
Hello.
The Russian media is reporting, and the Jerusalem Post reported this morning, something that seems to backstop something that you were reporting 5-6 months ago, which is that the Bush administration is planning to attack Iran. On the other hand, I just talked with Madeleine Albright, and she was of the opinion that perhaps the election of Democrats in the fall, and they're asserting some force now, might forestall that. What's your take on what's going on right now?
Well, of course, nobody knows. Actually, I've been writing for more than a year about the advance, you know, there's no question the president. I shouldn't say that. I know what the vice president thinks. None of us really know what the president thinks. We hear him make speeches. But in the White House, it's very hard to get any sense. You know, I've been reporting about nothing but 9/11 since 9/11 for the last 5.5 years, the same horrific story and horrible story, too. Depressing as no end. But you don't really know what the president says privately, but you can get a sense of what Cheney says. And Cheney wants to go. And I do believe, in as a general theory, that this is an administration that does not want to leave office with Iran, you know, still in the position they think it is, which is Iran's, of course, the winner of the war in Iraq, because there's very little doubt that Iraq, however it turns out, will be ruled by Shias. The Shias will very close to Iran. You're going to have a religious government in Iraq now, just like you have an Islamic religious government in both countries, Iraq and Iran. They're going to be very close together. Bush has done that for us for the next president, a great thank you. Bush does not want to leave them there. He wants to do something about it. Whether he can or not is what the call is. But we've been doing a lot, and of covert operations inside the country, a lot of planning by the armed forces, all of which I've written 4 stories or 5 stories in the last year and a half for the New Yorker. Johnny, one note on this. But having said that, and none of us know, but I'll just give you another way to think about things and sort of just to think about things differently. Okay, here are the Iranians listening to all this stuff, and as you may or may not know, and there really is no evidence that they have a bomb. The president and vice president are convinced they will, and they want to, yes, da-da-da, just like the WMD issue with Iraq 4 years ago. But the truth is there's no evidence at all, and the CIA has reported, and I've written all this, CIA said they find no evidence of what they call a parallel program. So let's assume that Iran doesn't have a bomb. They listen to all this stuff, Axis of Evil. And now they grab some Brits, and instead of letting them go, they go through a song and dance. They say they were in, it's all contested waters there. How anybody knows from one draft, you know, one inch to the next inch in that area between Iraq and Iran, it's basically uncharted. It's a vague claim to make. They're making the claim. They humiliate these people by showing photographs of them, you know, in captivity, writing letters. What are they doing? These guys have been weaving rugs for 2,000 years, one strand at a time. Why are they doing something seemingly so reckless? And I'll give you my sort of, if you will, heuristic, that is sort of my external analysis. And there's nothing. I haven't talked to anybody about this on the inside, but I'll just tell you what they're doing. They're saying to us, you want a bomb? Okay. Let's do it on our timing, not yours. We're saying to you, in effect, bring it on. Remember Bush's famous line to the Iraqis, bring it on. We're saying bring it on. You want to start bombing? You're doing all this big talk. We're giving you casus belli. You've got the chance. Go bomb. And, you know, they're pulling our chain, and they're going to get away with it. I did talk to somebody about it today who is pretty much convinced that they're going to come out the winners on this diplomatic skirmish, too, because nobody's ready. You know, this president just probably cannot do it now. He can do it maybe when he's ready, but he's not ready now.
So here we have two conflicting currents. One is that the winner of the Iraq war is Iran, and Bush and Cheney are committed to Iran not being a strong and powerful partner with Iraq, shall we say, by the time their administration ends a year and a half from now. And on the other hand, I'm hearing from sources within the military that the military is essentially broken, that we don't, I mean, you know, we have the capacity to drop a hell of a lot of ordnance on them, a lot of bombs, but you know, we have no follow through on Iran. So what do we do?
Well, you're absolutely right. You can bomb easily. You've got two carrier groups up there, and the Nimitz, the third one carrier, is going there, and the Navy has said that they're going to replace one of the ships that's on duty now, one of the carrier groups, about 6 boats around a carrier, has destroyers, et cetera. But actually, the truth is, we've got a tremendous amount of firepower up there. We also have a Marine unit up there, the Boxer, which is amphibious, 1,800 Marines. You have to bomb if you're going to do it. You have to do it by air. You can bomb from the Indian Ocean, too. The Israelis have five submarines capable of launching cruise missiles. You can put an awful lot of tonnage in there. The only thing that's on the ground you have to do is you have to send the Marines in probably. They have on, in the Gulf, the Iranians have silkworm missiles and exocets, very sophisticated missiles that you cannot hit out, suppressed by air. You've got to go in on the ground and blow them up individually. So it's messy. But they certainly can do that. 1,800 Marines, tough Marines, competent. A lot of bombing. Indian Ocean.
Well, if they don't do that this week, I mean, you know, the timeline given by the Russians was the 6th of April. If they don't do this week, do you expect that they will do it sometime between
now
and the
administration? Well, I don't know why the Russians would know anything more than anybody else knows. In the last story I did for the New Yorker a couple of weeks ago, I said that the president now has a 24-hour package. By that I mean the last requirement he's made of the Joint Chiefs is I want to wake up in the morning, scratch my nose, and say go, and I want stuff in the air in 24 hours, and he has that now. So I just don't know. I've heard a lot about the Russian thing, and I don't put much stake in it because I don't think and nobody knows anything. There's been no what they call frag order. There's been no order to attack. There's been a great deal of orders to do planning, and that you know it's beyond normal.
Could it be that this is the Russians playing chess with the oil in the area, that they're basically trying to prevent us from attacking by revealing our plans to attack?
Nah, I don't tell you. I honestly don't think so. I think it's way beyond that. Again, I don't know. You ask a question. The answer, I should say, is I don't know, but I doubt it only because certainly Saddam knew what we were going to do for for a year before we did it, and in 1991 he goes into Kuwait in August, and we don't attack till January. He's got 5 months to prepare for it. I mean, it's not as if there's going to be any surprise if we do something. The outstanding issues are: do we bring the Israelis along? Do we do it instead of them? The Israelis are champing at the bit to do this. They've always wanted, they view Iran as an existential threat, even more significant to them than Hezbollah, the militant Shiite group in Lebanon, only because Iran, in their view, could have a bomb or does have a bomb. But, the other way to look at it is to try and see it from Iran's point of view. And when you look at it from that point of view, what they're doing that seems to be provocative and crazy, they're responding to our provocative and crazy talk.
Right. And well, so, they're also. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, go ahead. No, I don't know what sanctions we keep on thinking we can cut them off. And these guys have been selling oil at $50-$60 a barrel for years. They got a lot of money.
Right. And they've seen us call Iraq and North Korea the axis of evil. And North Korea went out and said, Kim Jong-il thumbed his nose at us and very publicly and loudly got a bomb. And we didn't attack him. And Saddam Hussein, was saying, I got nothing. I got nothing. Come on in here. You can look around. Yeah, look under that rug. Look in this place. I got nothing. And we did bomb him and killed him. And so if I were an Iranian right now, I'd be thinking, Kim Jong-il's got something figured out here.
Yes, but I'll give you another way you could look at it, too. Also, if you're Bush and you want to bomb Iran, you really want to do it. And he's got the authority, by the way. He doesn't have to go to Congress. The famous resolution that was passed by the Senate in the fall of 2002, the one that John Kerry during the campaign said he would sign again, an all-time dumb line. That resolution gave the president the right to take preemptive action, including this kind of bombing, anywhere. It wasn't just limited to Iraq. The resolution passed by the Senate said anywhere he deems fit. I mean, it gave him incredible authority, really widespread authority. So he doesn't have to go back to Congress. But again, as I was saying, the Iranians they could view what happened to North Korea as George Bush cleaning up all the outstanding arguments against going. I mean, once he resolves the North Korean stuff, he's left, you know, he's shown he could be reasonable there, but the Iranians won't be reasonable. Therefore, that gives them another reason to attack Iran. You could view what Bush's sort of compromise, surprising compromise on Iran, on North Korea, as being related to sort of making it easier for him to sell the American people about the honesty of his intentions.
Right. And so the bottom line, we just have 10, 15 seconds left. The bottom line is that the risk of Bush attacking will exist right up through the end of his administration, period.
I'd say, until, 12 o'clock, 12, if he leaves at 12 or 1 until 12 that day.
Yeah.
Just start counting the days. I have been.
There you go. Okay. Goodbye. Seymour Hersh, the award-winning investigative journalist, NewYorker.com, the website. Thanks so much for being with us today. Great talking with you. 45 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. The place where our talking points come from, Jefferson and Madison, not some right-wing think tank. Stick around.
Truth in broadcasting. This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Harbin here with you on the radio support group of, by, and for We the People of the United States of America and all living things on planet Earth. 9.5 minutes before the hour. Doug in Staten Island. Hey, Doug, welcome to the program.
Good afternoon, Tom. Listen, I don't know the exact magazine because I didn't have a chance to get to my files. I've been on these programs many, many times, and I'm usually pretty aware of what's been said and so on. I just wanted to counter something with Cy Hersh, and I was wondering if you'd be kind enough to at least, if you take a look at this and put it counterposed to what Cy Hersh just said, because I know the way the blog works, and they'll quote Cy Hersh and say, you see, the president has the authority. My
right.
understanding is that Hegel, when he made this mad dash all of a sudden from a staunch conservative supporter of Bush, turned around and says, you should have seen this authorization. The president asked for carte blanche to bomb just any place in the Middle East. It was all over the place. Me, Biden, and Luca got together and changed the language and specified it. Now, I know that there's been a lot of talk. Wayne White, the former top analyst for the State Department, said that he saw the plan for the broad attack on Iran.
Yeah. Doug, what we're going to have to do is go back and find the language on the document, and I don't have it, but I do know that one of the things that authorization specified is that the president has to specify to Congress in writing before he commences bombing that he is, or within 3 days thereof, or something like that, something close to that, that in writing that the bombing is related to 9/11. And George Bush, in fact, did that. He did write a letter to Congress saying that he was attacking Iraq and it was related to 9/11.
Correct.
And so I believe that that is the only limitation. And as Cy Hersh said, and so if that's the only limitation, all he's got to do is go through some sort of twisted logic exercise and say, oh, no, Iran is somehow involved in 9/11 as well.
Correct.
So, if that's the case,
Tom, that doesn't work.
Well, it worked before.
Yeah, but how
in my opinion, he should be prosecuted right now for writing a letter to Congress saying that he attacked Iraq because of 9/11, because there was no connection. He knew there was no connection. And, that's one of the reasons that he was so flipped out about Joe Wilson.
I understand that. And some people have tortured the no pun intended. Some people have nuanced the language saying that there are two causes now and that any attack which the U.S. considers major by Iranian or Iranian-assisted forces. But, again, that is such a stretch on the language, Tom.
I absolutely agree with you, Doug, and it's a stretch that it wouldn't surprise me at all if Bush was to try to make. It just wouldn't surprise me at all. Thanks for the call. And Steve in Santa Rosa. Hey, Steve.
Hey, Tom. How are you this morning? I know you're great, but you're going to get better.
There you go.
I'm a typical wine-drinking, cheese-eating liberal from Sonoma County, California.
Okay.
And I wanted to talk to you
kind.
About... Huh?
The best kind.
Yeah. Hey, on this news agency about bombing on the 6th, maybe I'm wrong, but wasn't it amended to around the 17th?
I don't know. The Jerusalem Post is yesterday or today was quoting the article that said the 6th, and the one that I had, you know, we did about an hour on it about a week and a half ago when it first broke in the Russian media, and it was the 6th. I haven't, you know, I haven't seen a specific, although I may be misremembering.
You know, I do remember, and somewhere right after that was released, it was amended to the 17th.
Yeah.
But anyway,
I think Cy Hirsch's point is well taken, you know, that the Russians don't have any control over what Bush and Cheney are doing.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and I just go ahead.
Oh, if it is on the 17th, 17th through the 20th, I believe. But Alberto Gonzalez goes before Congress on the 17th.
Oh, geez, what a great diversion. Steve, thanks for making my day. Jeez, Jeff in Tacoma, Washington. Hey, Jeff.
Hey, thanks for having me on, Tom. One thing I was hoping you would get into with Madeleine Albright is the disastrous impact the Bush administration has had on the State Department as a whole with Condoleezza Rice, John Bolton, and just a whole lot of bad decisions. I wonder if you'd go into that.
Yeah, well, it would have been a good topic. There were a number of things that, you know, in reflection, I wish I had raised with her, her justification of the impact on the children of the embargo against Iraq, for example, during the Clinton administration. I mean, I did what I did at the time that I did it, and you know, it'd be great to go back and redo it, but I can't. Ty from Santa Fe, New Mexico. Hey, Ty, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom. Appreciate talking to you. I consider you a patriot.
Thank you.
Tom, I want to ask you if there's any, if anybody's considered that the state of Israel would actually provoke something, maybe a torpedo into a carrier, for one of our ships in the Gulf, or even an incident here on our continent that would provoke us to attack Iran.
I doubt that they would do anything like that without permission of the Bush administration or the encouragement of the Bush administration, although the USS Liberty does give one pause, but Sharon is not around anymore. So I'm frankly very skeptical of that. And frankly, I'm not sure that that would be in their best interest. You know, one of the things that most Americans don't realize is that these topics are debated loudly and longly and publicly in Israel, whereas here in the United States there's actually very little discussion about Israel's role or you know, what it should be or what it shouldn't be in the Middle East and war and all these other countries and things. It blows my mind how open the conversation is there and how it just doesn't even get touched here. But frankly, Ty, I doubt it. I just doubt it. Thanks for the call, though. Joe in El Paso, Texas. Hey, Joe.
Hey, how's it going, Tom?
Just great. We've only got a few seconds before we've got to wrap up this hour of the show, Joe. So quick note.
Yes, I just wanted to say that if we go to war with Iran, we're probably going to have to reinstate the draft because nobody's going to enlist.
Yeah, well, see, that's the thing. I think what Bush thinks he can have is a nice little surgical strike where he just drops a whole bunch of bombs, maybe some tactical nukes, and you know, dusts his hands off at the end of the day and says, well, that's it. We took care of Iran, and there is no, you know, blah-de-blah. Blah. And that, you know, it won't, he's not going to get into a Rumsfeldian mess. But time will tell. Time will tell. Coming up Wednesday on the next Tom Hartman program on Air America Radio, I'll be challenging conservative Yaron Brook, who's stopping by on behalf of predatory lenders. In our Everything You Know Is Wrong segment, Daniel Sheehy is here about merging the U.S. and Mexico. Larry Scott is going to drop by with VAWatchdog.org and talk about the most current veterans issues. And as always, the best of the rest of the news and your calls right here on the Tom Hartman program, your radio support group for We the People on Air America Radio. And never forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Activism begins with you. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. For exclusive Tom Hartman archives and more information, visit us online at airamericaradio.com.
By using 80 Kessler.